Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Tommy Pico is a Brooklynite of many years. He was raised on the Viejas Reservation of the Kumya Nation outside San Diego. In Feed, the fourth and final book-length poem in a series, unofficially titled The Teeb Cycle, Pico explores what it means to hunger for justice and love and what it means to be nourished spiritually. The New York Times called it, quote, exhilarating, permissive, intimate. While The New Yorker called Feed, quote, brightly discombobulated, written on the wing, full of grabbed meals, lucky sex, and appealing corny jokes. Tommy Pico is also co-host of the podcast Food for Thought and Scream Queens, and a screenwriter for the excellent FX series Reservation Dogs. He joined me earlier this year to talk about Feed, which is described in the synopsis as, quote, a poem of nourishment. So I asked him what kind of nourishment he was talking about.
Well, there is an idea. Well, with Junk, you know, that was a poem of trying to just maintain a vigor, like as if it was just simple carbohydrates and sugar. Whereas Feed is more complex carbohydrates. It's more vegetables, and it's more about cooking and nourishing yourself and learning not just how to accept nourishment from others, but how to create nourishment within oneself. That's the process of writing for me. That was the process of writing the book, was learning how to cook, going to other people's places and cooking with them and learning their food histories and their stories, because a lot of my own culturally had been robbed from me and my grandmother's generation with the boarding school system in Southern, in along the California coast. So it was reclaiming that and creating new stories and trying to also just have a good time and have Indian joy and Indian humor and Indian laughter and Indian fun amongst the indigenous pain.
Some of the poem is framed around a walk along the High Line in Chelsea. And every couple of pages you list like types of plants where one would see like the placards, the informational placards. Why did you want to place the readers on the High Line?
There was something about the history, the construction, and then later the reclamation of the High Line that I thought dovetailed with the speaker's journey through the poem quite nicely. I mean, I had been commissioned to write a portion of this poem for the launch of the Ephemerals Garden of the High Line one spring. And I learned about the history of the High Line Park and how it used to be a station where for transporting goods from farms in upstate New York to then distribute around the city and around the world. So it was a hub of feed, rather. And that later it went derelict and it became a wild garden in a city, in the biggest city in America, and or a busy city, and that later was reappropriated to become a park. And the speaker's relationship to the love interest, Leo, in this poem was one of, you know, sometimes in order to figure, I mean, this is just my personal opinion when it comes to being friends with exes, especially ones that have had a particular, ones that have had a particular effect on your life, that in order for me to become friends, I need to not see you for a very long time. I need to recalibrate my hormones. I need to understand you as a person who's entering a new life of mine and not try to reclaim an old one. And so the idea was that in order for the High Line Park to become what it was, you had to let go of it and come back to it later on.
After one of these episodes, you pondered the difference between lonely and alone, and reading that now after the past year had a very different, felt it was really poignant to me. I want to read this out loud.
Tell me about it.
There it is. It says, what is the difference between being alone and being lonely? Alone is a physical feeling, literal proximity, just not being around other bodies. Lonely is a desire, the urge for a companion or sympathetic compatibility, something on the other side of the country, something shivering or like feeling incomplete, right? How do you feel about that, what you've written now?
I honestly, what day is it? You know, like what the thing also, like I live in Los Angeles now. So it's like, I don't even get the seasonal reminders that the calendar is passing. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like, I've been in this stasis. Everyone's kind of been in a kind of stasis. And I think that my relationship to loneliness and being alone now is just, I've tried to find ways of connecting. I mean, trying to find ways of connecting that aren't physical was a kind of undertow of this book, because it's partly about someone who is on a tour. And being on a tour is like it's really lonely, and there are selective periods of being really intensely social, but mostly, you know, you're not around people who you love and adore, or I mean, you're not around familiars. You're around new people all the time, so you're performing a self, and you don't really get to sit in yourself with other people. And I honestly, like, though, like, so many things are blurring, and so is, like, my definition of being alone and being lonely. And search me. I'll have an answer for that in a year, probably.
Okay. We'll mark the calendar and check back with you. My guest is Tommy Teebs-Pico. We're talking about his work as a poet. Tommy, you have a passage to read for us from Feed, your most recent book. Let's go for it.
All right. So if you want to follow along, this is from page 11 in Feed.
Okay.
Dear reader, a rue I've learned tonight in this mid-city dinner party apartment tucked somewhat safely away from asthmatic LA freeways is the mixture of butter and flour used to swell sauces and soups and Paul's baked sage mac and cheese that I'm whisking alive like an al dente evanescent cheese rock bop. Whistle while you whisk away the rage scrunched in your boulders. I says to them around the table, I says, I don't have a food history. If the dish is subjugate an indigenous population, here's an ingredient of the roux. Alienate us from our traditional ways of gathering and cooking food. Kumeyaays moved around what would be called San Diego County with the seasons, the mountains, the valleys, the coasts. Not much arable land or big game, so we followed the food wherever it would go. Then the missions, then isolated reservations on stone mountains where not even a goat could live. Then the starvation, then the food distribution program on Indian reservations. Whatever the military would throw away came canned in the backs of trucks. The commodities, the powdered milk, worms in the oatmeal, corn, syrupy canned peaches, food stripped of its nutrients. Then came the sugar blood, the sickness. The glucose meter goes up and up and up. I says to them around the table, I says, I don't have food stories. With you, I say, I'm cooking new ones. End of excerpt.
That excerpt takes one on a journey. It really does. I mean, you start with this sort of dinner party food discussion into this entry point of a much bigger and important conversation about systemic malnourishment of Native peoples and what that does to people's health. When did you write that? And two, do you have that mapped out already when you're writing, or is it just a flow thing?
Well, I started this because a part of the project of the book, as I mentioned earlier, was to learn how to cook. And so I traveled around the country. I was in Seattle. I was in Portland. I was in L.A. I was in Tampa. I was in Portland. Both I was in Maine and Oregon. I was in New York and Philly and Baltimore, and just like sharing space and table space and kitchen space with people and listening to their stories. And I would go to them and say, what's a dish that when you at the cookout, that's what they want? They want your this. Mm-hmm. Or what's your favorite thing? What's the first thing you learned how to cook? What's something that you learned how to cook from your mother, your father, your grandmother, or whatever? And we would just do that. And I would learn about their food histories and their food stories. And the thing is, like, I didn't know why. And it's not ultimately important for me to know why when I'm writing poetry. I just need something instinctually to kick off. And this is something that I've learned and that I have carved in my own writing process, is to learn how to write and create and piece together from instinct rather than from taste. And it takes a lot of getting out of a mindset of intimidation. I have to get out of this idea of needing to craft something good or something funny or something smart or something poignant, you know, and just realize that this is my job. Like, this is what I do. I've worked really, really hard to be able to write from a place of instinct. So I owe it to myself to trust myself that if I have the impulse to write towards something, that it's going to take me there. All I need is a little push. All I need is a little velocity. And those things I found that I find them because I have a really restless mind, and and I don't, it's hard for me. I don't know if this is like a Sagittarius thing, but it's just, I'm not satisfied with anything. And so if I just follow, and I deeply believe that there is connective tissue between every single thing in the universe. You just have to find the string. And so that, I feel like that's my job, is to just figure out the string, figure out the connective tissue, and really give myself, in order to nourish my creativity, just, you know, give myself the space to figure out what those connections are.
My guest is poet Tommy Teebs Pico. Now, Feed is the fourth of your four book-length poems. Why do you gravitate towards book-length poems?
I was initially very, very scared. I wrote a lot, most of my writing, before finding the form that really took me on the journey that I needed to go on. I would get these comments from people that they would say, oh, I feel like this is a little short, or I feel like you took the easy way out, or I feel like you could go further with this idea. And I don't take criticism very well. So I was just like, well, if you want to write the poem, then you write the poem. This is my poem. This is what I want to do. But, you know, it's a refrain that kept popping up. And I think if you're going to write well, you have to be a really great listener. And so I just started to listen to them and to really interrogate why it was that I was afraid of this form. And ultimately, I didn't think I had the attention span. I didn't think I had the wherewithal. I didn't think I was a good enough reader, frankly, to parse my way through a long poem. But then I listened to Beyonce's self-titled album. It dropped on my birthday, December 13th, I believe it was 2013, and it completely changed my idea of what long poems are and what they are and could do and what they could look like and how they could sound, because I do believe that Beyonce's self-titled album is an epic poem. And then I started to read A.R. Ammons and M. Carson and Claudia Rankine and people like that. And I understood that the long poem was, you know, it's something that you live with and you grow with and you read and it becomes a part of you. It imprints on you and you imprint on it a little bit. And I also understood as I was writing my first book that I wasn't taking my cue from these longer works of these poets that I'd come to, that there was actually something deeper and cellular inside of me, and that my relationship to long poems was actually my relationship to these indigenous song cycles called bird songs, these Kumeyaay bird songs that I grew up listening to. My father is a bird singer. It's like the first music I ever heard, and I used to fall asleep in the doorframe way past my bedtime as my father and my uncles would be singing the bird songs in the living room, and there are these epic song cycles that are sung over the course of the night that in some of them detail who Kumeyaay people are and how we got to the valley we lived in and what we passed on our way, kind of like a travelogue. And I started understood that my poems were an innovation on the ancient art of the Kumeyaay bird song. And instead of talking about how Kumeyaays got into the valley that they lived in, mine were illustrative of where I came out of the valley and how I moved into the world. And understanding that that was my legacy was just like, that was the most clarifying information I've ever received in my entire life, because it was like I was making good on the promise of my ancestors, to be cheesy, like that they had seen a glimmer of me in the past. They had survived so that I could innovate on this ancient art.
That was my conversation with poet Tommy Pico, whose latest book-length poem is titled Feed. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, and I will meet you back here after the news.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.